with the hopefully where we left off with my grandfather, the Vavilov of Ben Sion. Being that it has been probably a good month or better since I last addressed the subject, I'm really not completely certain exactly what it was that I did or didn't cover already. I believe we were in the midst of some anecdotes about the measure of this person's intellectual and spiritual stature. And I told you a number of anecdotes about his wisdom, which established an international reputation for him as being a very sagacious person. In in the city of Zeklachin, which was a community near Tuvna, one of the larger communities of Galicia, there was a chassid by the name of Reb Hirsch Klingenfach. Reb Hirsch was a very quality person of great quality. He was a very great Talmud Chacham, a person who had a really extraordinary command of all of the Talmudic and halachic literature. He was a person who refused the honors of serving as rov in the community. Offers were which were made to him because of his great erudition, and he preferred to be a merchant because that really afforded him a great deal of time undisturbed to be able to learn to daven. He was able to he had some very special connections with the pritzim in those days, the people who had large sums of money, who were part of the kind of the nobility of Poland and that era. And he would deal in all kinds of merchandise. Amongst which some of his best customers were these pritzim, were these nobility who would buy large volumes of merchandise from him. In 1931, I should preface this by saying, as he got older, Reb Hirsch turned the business over to his son-in-law, so that his son-in-law really gradually began to take a larger and larger responsibility in conducting the affairs of the business. And while they were both involved in it for a period of time, Reb Hirsch's responsibilities began to diminish, and his son-in-law would gradually assume more and more of the function of the business, to travel to these pritzim, to travel to these very well-to-do, extremely rich landowners and nobility, and do business with them. So in 1931, Reb Hirsch took sick, and as his health deteriorated, it became increasingly clear to his family and friends that he was not likely to recover. One day he sent for the rabbi and some of the prominent members of the community. This Sekhlechin was a very strong. It was a stronghold of Bava V'chassidim. There were many Bava V'chassidim there, and the rabbi was a Bava V'chassid himself. In any event, he sent for them, and they gathered about his bed, and he kind of like summoned his last energies to sit up in bed. He sat up and he said to them, I feel that my strength is waning, and I suspect that my ability to talk is not going to be with me for very much longer, and I feel obliged to share with you an incident which will give you a greater appreciation of our Rebbe. So he related that his son-in-law was doing business with a Puritz and had done a very substantial volume of business with this Puritz, who was buying on credit. After a while, this Puritz came to the son-in-law and said to him, look, here's the deal. I will pay you half of what I owe you. I want you to write off the other half. And just to make the deal more attractive to you, if you don't accept this proposal, I want you to know I'm going to go to the authorities and report that you sold me smuggled merchandise which was contraband in Poland. So the pastor related that his son-in-law was indignant. He said, I've never ever sold you any merchandise which was contraband, and I refuse to be extorted. I'm an honest businessman. I want you to pay me what I owe you. So the guy turned around and stormed out, and within short order, the son-in-law received a summons to appear in court, which was something less than 2 weeks away from that particular date. Now, they knew that it really was a matter of very, very small effort on the part of this Puritz to introduce merchandise which was really illegally imported into the country, which he would have gotten from any number of places, and just to put it in amongst the stuff that he had sold. But it really was small-time stuff. To be able to do that, the evidence would be stacked against him, and then he would be sentenced to some, which in those days was not only a long prison sentence, but it was the conditions of the prisons were terrible. So this was really a very serious business. And when he came, when his son-in-law came and reported to Reb Hirsch what had transpired, Reb Hirsch immediately took off for Babov. So he came to Babov Erev Shabbos. He resolved that on Shabbos he was not going to disturb the Rebbe with his problem. But on Sunday, first thing in the morning, Reb Hirsch went into the Rebbe and gave him the kvittel, gave him this little piece of paper upon which he'd written all the relevant information, his name, his son-in-law's name, you know. And then he elaborated on the problem, and he said, it's not only my son-in-law's in trouble, he says, I'm in trouble, he says, our entire fortune is at stake here, everything is going to get wiped out. And of course he was very frightened, and he wept bitterly about this problem. The Rebbe looked into the kvittel, looked up at him, looked back into the kvittel, and said to him, Kabash, why don't you remain here for a while? I'll tell you when it's time for you to go back home. So Reb Hirsch was somewhat, this kind of gave him a boost, and he went out and sat himself down in Beis Medrash, and he learned all day. By the end of the day, he became apprehensive again, and once again he went into the Rebbe and said, Rebbe, you know, I really need to go back home because I need to hire an attorney. We don't have very much time. The Rebbe said to him, there's time. I'll let you know. Rabbi Hashua happened to have been on Masvin, so he went back, learned some more in Bismillah. The following day, first thing in the morning, he's by the Rebbe again. Rebbe, what do I do? The Rebbe says to him again, I'll let you know. He says, but Rebbe, he says, you know, time is of essence over here. I need to get a good attorney. I need to be able to figure out how we're going to defend ourselves against these trumped up charges. Rebbe says to him, Hash, trust in me, I'll let you know. Monday night, Reb Hirsch went in again to the Rebbe, and again the Rebbe reassured him that he would let him know when to go. Monday night, Reb Hirsch couldn't sleep. He was so tense about this problem that it was impossible to sleep. And the following morning, right after the davening, he just couldn't hack it anymore. So he went into the Rebbe again with a kvittel. And this time he said to the Rebbe, I can't stay here anymore. I must leave. And the Rebbe looked at him, looked down into the kvittel, looked up at him again a number of times, looked up at him, looked down at the kvittel. And then he sort of kind of went into this very intense, focused state of concentration. And finally, he looked up, reached his hand out and clasped Reb Hirsch's hand, and he said to him, go back. And he quoted to him a pasuk in Yeshaya, Ve'etein Adam Tachtecha. The pasuk translated literally means, I will give another person in your stead. I will place another person, I'll substitute another person for you. That's the kind of the, someone else will take the heat, as it were. And he wished him well, and Reb Hirsch walked out. He had absolutely no idea what that was all about, and how he should interpret it. But he immediately ran to catch the train, and on the way home, he had to change trains. The station was a place called Gramnik. So when he got to Gramnik, as he got off his train, began to go over to the platform where he was going to catch a train to go to his own community, his son-in-law runs to greet him, and he's got this beautiful smile on his face. He's beaming. He says to him, his father-in-law, before the Bashkets sending them, he says to him, do I have news for you? He says, the Pulitz today, that is this morning, he says, got into a big argument with his wife, and he was in such a state that he took a gun, put it to his head, and killed himself. He said, there's no... The prosecution is gone. There's no plaintiff anymore. So he said, so the case was thrown out of court, and we have nothing to worry about. So Reb Hirsch concluded the story. He said to him, I didn't want to die, he says, with this story untold. He said, I just want you to know what the greatness of the Rebbe is. And a number of days later, Reb Hirsch passed away. A number of other incidents which were also of interest. The Rebbe suffered from arthritis. It's kind of like a family thing, actually. My mother, blessed memory, also suffered from arthritis. In any event, they were anxious to try to see if they could find some place where he might feel more comfortable. So they were informed of a very rural village called Ehrensdorf. The air was supposed to be very, very good there, and I can't recall whether or not there was any special mineral baths there, but it was supposed to be a really very pleasant environment. And the Rebbe and a group of Chassidim made this journey to Ehrensdorf. Before the Rebbe came, some of the Chassidim went to try to find a place where he might be in, knowing that the likelihood that the Chassidim from the entire region would converge on this place. They went to try to rent some large hall where they could daven, where they could have the tishin, Friday, Shabbos, whatever, the whole nine yards. So they found the place, and this fellow was a Polish peasant, a rather unpleasant lout by the name of Binnick. And he really had the only place in that area that could serve this function. There was a kind of like a large, it was a granary, a storage place for grain, where that could be converted into a besmedrish and a place where they would be able to have these tishim. So they made up with him a contract for about a month or so. And by the time my grandfather arrived there, there was already interest in the area. There were already Chassidim who were renting places all around the area to be close to the where they were going to be davening and stuff. And this Benik fellow became very difficult. He said, "I'm sorry, I'm not going to let you use this place, and you have to pay me more money." He just made things impossible. And my grandfather felt very uncomfortable and began to say to the, he said, "I want to get out of here." They had already given him, Binnick, a very, very healthy deposit. They didn't want to lose this money. And he finally said, "You know what, you can use, I have all of this farmland, put up whatever you want on this farmland." So they went ahead and they found someone to draw up real fast plans, and they threw up a huge, also a similar type of thing, but bigger than the first. Also something which could be used to house or to store grain and hay and stuff. This huge place. And this Binnick made it impossible. Every step along the way, you can't walk here and you can't do here and you got to, you have to end it this time. He just was making things impossible. Every 3 minutes he was changing the conditions and the prices. And my grandfather was just beside himself. He just wanted to get out of this place. And Chassidim kept on convincing him, "No, you have to be here, you have to rest, this is a good place for you." Anyway, against his will, he stayed there. And, of course, hundreds and hundreds of Chassidim began to travel, to spend time with the Rebbe in this country surrounding. And the townspeople were also no lovers of Jews. So it became a very tense environment. Towards the conclusion of the second week, a woman, a widow, came from the area to ask the counsel of the Rebbe about a problem that she was having. She was a widow for many years. She was very poor. She had a 14-year-old son. And inasmuch as she really did not have the wherewithal to support him, she was considering an invitation that the youngster had received from an uncle, that he should come to Berlin, where he would send him to school, and he would take care of him. Now, going to Berlin, going to a school in Berlin in those days, was a ticket to apostasy, a ticket to throwing away one's Judaism. There were no survivors from that thing. So, my grandfather said to her, "Why in the world would you want to do that to your son?" So she said, "Rebbe, I have no money. I can't do anything for him." So he said to her, "Because you have no money, you want to make a goy out of your son?" So she said, "Well, Rebbe, what should I do?" So he said to her, "Give him to me, and I will provide for him. You won't have another word." So they talked about that option, and finally she agreed. And with that, her son, Shlomo Goldstein, became a personal, the personal responsibility, one of the adopted children of the Babava family. The moment that she left, my grandfather called together his gaboyim. He said to them, "Now I know why I came here, and now that I've accomplished what I came here to do, we are leaving now." So they tried to prevail on him again, and he said, "Till now," he said, "I allowed you to persuade me to stay because I couldn't figure out why I was here." He said, "But now that I know why I came, I'm not staying here one second longer. We're leaving." Anyway, nobody could convince him to stay. They packed their bags within hours. And at that point, Benek came along and said, "I'm not allowing you to leave until you pay me for the next 3 weeks." They said to him, "Our contract reads that we could leave at the conclusion of our original contract. And what's more, that you would give us back money for the time that we didn't stay here." They said to him, "We're leaving you this building," which in and of itself was a fortune to throw up. He said, "You're not leaving here until you pay me for the, not only for the full 4 week, but for the whatever extension we had talked about." Anyway, they were going to take the matter to court. And my grandfather said to him, "Pay him off, or we're getting out of here." So they saw that the Rebbe's mind was made up. And as they were walking out, my grandfather said to him, "After you've paid him, see to it that you say to him in the company of his neighbors, tell him that his fate has been spoken for by the wisest of all men, by King Solomon." King Solomon said in a pasuk, "Eisa oisher v'lei b'mishpat," he who gathers wealth without in unjust ways, in the midst of his days, it will take leave of him. And with that, the entire entourage left. Less than a week afterwards, they received news from Ehrensdorf that out of a clear sky, a bolt of lightning hit one of the farmhouses, that the entire farm went up in fire in a matter of minutes, went from building to building, destroyed everything that this man owned. That they were running around with his neighbors, trying to find some way to put out the fire, but it was such a devastating fire that in the shortest amount of time, the entire thing went out. Now, had this fire begun under any other circumstances, it would have been blamed on some one of these Hasidim who were trying to do something to get back at him. But this was a bolt of lightning out of a clear blue sky, and it left everyone, both in Ehrensdorf and in Bobov, with a deeper sense of reverence for the measure of this man. A similar incident occurred on a Rosh Hashanah when my grandfather would daven Musafim, the Musaf prayer. He would daven. He himself was the Shliach Tzibur, and because there were many more Hasidim than could go into the Beis Medrash, they would put the bima from which he would daven right near the window, and there was. He was a very moving, very stirring Baal Tefillah. And there was a young man who was pretty rabid, anti-Semite, and he concealed himself in a strategic place. And when my grandfather was davening for the Amid, he picked up a wicked rock and flung it through the window. Right where and as it happened, it missed him by a hairline. In less than a day or so after that, this fellow fell off of a wagon, broke his arm. They were unable to repair it in any other way. It was so badly broken that they had to amputate it. And through the throughout the countryside, chassidim by chassidim, it was hard to add to the way in which they revered the Rebbe, but the non-Jewish populace who already had a very deep respect for the Rebbe knew that this was that he was not a man to be trifled with. Those were some of the things that occurred during the period of time before the Almighty concealed his face. But when in 1939 there was this Hesta upon him where the Almighty turned away from his people and the slaughter of 6 million innocents began. Even the sanctity and the greatness of this man was vulnerable to this horrific devastation which exacted its toll on a third of our people. About a week before Rosh Hashanah, when the war broke out, the entire family fled Babov. And that began a series of wanderings, which had them. It's a long and tortured story, with moments of greatness, not only on the part of the Rebbe, but on the part of Yibod Lachem Tevim of today's Bava Varov, members of the family. There, it was an extraordinary chapter in the history of the family, but. It finally ended up that my grandfather found refuge in Lemberg, which was a large, very large city, and there were some well-to-do and influential Jews. Now, throughout this period of time, interestingly enough, my father, Zechen Vlacha, tried to get papers to bring my grandfather over to America. My father told me that in the course of doing so, he was advised that it was critical for him, as much as one of the premises of bringing him over was that the Bava Rebbe was a man of international spiritual prominence, that he should get the signature and the personal attestation of the Archbishop of this area. My father told me that he had a personal audience with the Archbishop, and he pleaded the case of my grandfather, and the Archbishop refused to sign. There were periods of time in which he could have gotten out. He did not take advantage of this. Was before things deteriorated. In other words, there was a period of time in which he could have gotten papers. But this was already during a period in which his son, Chaim Shia, had been taken off to Siberia by the Russians. The communists said, during one of their, when they were still friendly with the Germans, had come in and taken thousands. I think it was something like 100,000 Jews were sent off to Siberia, many of whom perished. And the cold was unspeakable, and there was no food, and the conditions were such that thousands and thousands of Jews died from exposure to cold and hunger and disease and whatnot. During this period of time, my grandfather from Lemberg was able to send different things, food and whatnot, to Siberia, to his son Chaim Shia, to my uncle, to sustain him. He was able to trade merchandise there and get things for himself and whatnot. So when he could have gotten out, he didn't, because as long as he was able to do something for his son in Siberia, he did not want to leave. Once he was in America, there wasn't going to be anything he was going to be able to do from there. By the time he recognized that there was no alternative but to leave, he couldn't leave. On Rosh Chodesh Av in 1940, the Nazis took my grandfather and many hundreds of Jews, perhaps thousands, I'm not sure, prisoner, marched them out. He was wearing his shtreimel. He was in his Shabbos clothes. And they beat him. And his shtreimel and his kapel fell off. For him to stop only meant that they would beat him more. He bent down, picked up his yarmulke, walked another few steps. They beat him again. His yarmulke fell off. He walked back, picked up his yarmulke a number of times. He refused to remain with his to walk without his head covered. And finally, on it was a Monday, Monday or Tuesday, was the fourth day of Av. They shot my grandfather along with his son Moshe Aaron. His teenage years, and three of his sons-in-laws, the three of my uncles, in outside of Lemberg, and that was the conclusion of this chapter in the story of Bubbev. Thank the good Lord, my uncle, through many miracles, survived the war. Uncle Tzlang lived to Kiyor and made it back, made it to America, where he recreated the legacy of Bubbev and has done so in a way which is perhaps no less miraculous than many of the wondrous events that surrounded the lives of his fathers before him. So I might urge anybody who wants to see Chassidus in our time, which is a very beautiful Chassidus and a very moving Chassidus, that it would be well worth their while to spend Shabbos in Bubbev. It's a inspiring and enriching experience in every which way, from the Rebbe to the Chassidim to the both in quality and quantity. It's really an amazing scene. I'd like to share with you one or two Teiras with which we'll close this chapter, which involve both the approach of my great-grandfather and my grandfather. Needless to say, my grandfather drew considerably on some of the commentary of his father. Typical of some of the things that one would have been treated to in Bubbev was a Torah which my grandfather used to explain a Gemara. There are two volumes so far, two volumes of commentary, which is predominantly on the Sedras, but also includes on Tehillim and Anach and some in Pirkei Avos and some of the Gemaras and some of the Yom Tovim and so on. So the works of my grandfather are called Kedushas Tzion. His name being Ben Tzion, it's called Kedushas Tzion. And the commentary of my great grandfather, whose name was, if you remember, was Shlema, so that's called Ater Shlema, the Crown of Shlema. In any event, there's the in the Kedushas Tzion in Parshas Chayei, my grandfather explains the Gemara. The Gemara in Chulin says that the Pinchas ben Yoyah said to the sage Rebbe, he exclaimed, "Yisrael Kedeshimim." He said, "Israel is a holy people." And he goes on to explain. Why are they holy? Because there are Jews, Yesh Reitzavainla, he says there are Jews who want to give, they want to be generous, they want to be charitable, but they don't have the wherewithal. And there are others, Sheyesh Levin Reitzav, there are others who have and don't want to give. This was his commentary, this was Pinchas ben Yoyah's observation about God's holy people. So Tosfos over there says, okay, we understand why you would describe someone who doesn't have any money and wants to give as being holy. He wants to do the right thing. But why would you describe somebody who does have the wherewithal to give, but any right say he doesn't want? He can. He has the resources, but he doesn't want. Why would you describe that person as being holy? How does that belong under the same roof, the same descriptive category? Yisrael Kadesh, they're holy because of this. So, my grandfather uses a commentary of his father. The verse in Parshas Chayei says about charity, Nasein titein lai, you shall surely give to the poor man. And your heart shall not hurt you. Parenthetically, this same comment is to be found in some other svarim, but this was an original comment on his part. So my great-grandfather explained it the following way. He said that when a person who has the capacity to give, to be charitable, comes upon someone else who is suffering, he's suffering poverty, he's in great need, and he sees that this person is hungry, he sees that this person is wearing clothing which is threadbare, he sees that the circumstances of his life are very dire, so he's moved to want to do something for him. Why? Because he's in pain. The person who sees the other person's plight is himself in a state of pain. He's agonized by this person's deprivation. So he gives. Why does he give? He gives to assuage his own hurt. I can't bear to see this level of deprivation. I want to give to you to take care of the fact that I'm hurt. So he says, while that's very wonderful, this person in giving is serving himself. Because he knows he's in comfortable conditions. He feels uncomfortable that someone else doesn't have. But that is not the ideal form of charity. The ideal form of charity is to give because God wants us to give. Because our understanding is that the Almighty has appointed us as stewards, guardians over this money, because he entrusts it to us that we'll know what to do with it. So our understanding should be, our attitude should be, not I'm giving because I'm in pain, I'm giving because the Almighty, who has given me the money, has instructed me to be benevolent. That's charity. Charity is, real Jewish charity, is not giving to serve me, but to serve God. Not because I want to assuage my own pain, but because I want to do what is just and correct and appropriate in the eyes of the Almighty.
Where's the emotion?
What?
It seems to transform from an emotional to an intellectual.
Not necessarily intellectual, but one of service. One of, I'm doing it in deference to the Almighty's. In other words, in much the same way that I do a mitzvah with joy. Why do I do it with joy? Because I feel privileged to fulfill God's will. You should do this mitzvah with joy because it's an opportunity for him to fulfill the divine.
And what happens to the natural feelings he has of
hurt? He needs to place himself in the right frame of reference. It's an act of focus. It's an act of taking your whole person and putting it in the right place. So he says that's the meaning of the pasuk. No saying titeinu, you shall surely give him. But v'le'yera levavcha b'sitlei, your heart shouldn't hurt you when you're giving him. Because if your heart is hurting you, then you're giving in deference to your heart. You should be giving. So one of the ways to do that, by the way, is to give enough so that you become satisfied that the person is no longer in need, and then if you give him again, then you're no longer giving out of hurt. So that's the reason that the verb nosein titen is repeated, give and give again, give until it no longer hurts you. In other words, you're no longer giving out of a sense of you're agonized by it. When you've reached that point, now you're fulfilling the mitzvah of charity. That's what my great-grandfather commented. My grandfather used that. So he said, and with this, he says, we can also explain the Gemara. When the Gemara says that Jews are holy, and describe two categories. One category is the Jew who gives, who wants to give, and doesn't have. And the other one is a category of one who gives, of one who has, and doesn't want to give. So he says it doesn't mean that he doesn't give. He does give. What it's telling us is that he gives out of a frame of mind that he doesn't want to. In other words, he's reached this point where he gives out of a sense of service to the Almighty, not because he wants. I want to give because I'm hurting, so I'm giving. He says this person is a holy person because he gives out of a sense of deference to the divine will. Yeshla, he has, and he doesn't want. At that point, where he no longer wants, and he is giving charity. That was the comment of my great grandfather. Similarly, in another verse in Parshas Re'eh, he makes a wonderful observation about this pasuk, ki pasayach tiftach es yad cholai, you shall surely, and again it repeats the verb, open, you shall open your hand to him, to the poor person, and you shall loan this person de machseirei, the adequate amount of that which he is missing. Again, a verse which tells us how we're to conduct ourselves in charity. And my great-grandfather's comment on this was as follows. He said that our state of mind, the conventional state of mind, would be as follows. Somebody comes to us, a poor person comes to us, and asks us for a charity. So we know that this poor person it's a genuine business, and this is not a fraud. We know that this guy is really a poor person, and he's in great need. And so we give him a handsome donation. So let's say we give this person $50. A short time later, we discover that this poor person, who we gave money to, turned around and gave some other poor person charity, gave him $10 charity. So we are outraged. What nerve! You know, you come to us for money and you turn around and you give away $10 to somebody else. You know, I gave to you because you were in need. What right do you have to give my money to somebody else? Or the person comes to us for a loan, we know he's in great need, we give it to him, he turns around and loans it to a poor person. We say, what kind of business is it? What kind of nerve is that? So he says that that's not the Jewish attitude. The Jewish attitude is that just as the rich give charity, the poor are also obliged to give charity. There is dignity in giving. And to give to a poor person, to allow them the dignity of being able to also to participate in the act of giving, is in and of itself is an act of charity. It's not only what you give him so that he can buy food, but if you give him the wherewithal so that he can feel like he has the dignity of being able to give to someone else, that is a very great act of charity. And for that reason, he says the verb of opening your hand is repeated twice, because it's talking once about opening your hand to enable the poor person to open up his hand. And that is a legitimate attitude in charity. My grandfather, using his father's commentary on this pasuk in Re'eh, said that with this, one is able to explain a verse in Tehillim. In Psalms, it says, Pisa nosan levyanim, that a person was very expansive and very generous in giving to the Evyoin. Evyoin is a person who's destitute. So it says, Pisa nosan levyoinim, tzidkosoi emedis load. Someone who gives in this very expansive way to the destitute, his charity and righteousness shall endure forever. So he says, what this refers to is someone who is a pazron, someone who is so generous, so as to give to a destitute person to give him the wherewithal and the dignity to be able to participate in the mitzvah of charity. He says, you not only have fulfilled the mitzvah of charity on your own, but you also have a portion in the charity which this person did for somebody else. So he says, Pisa, no son of Yenim, if you were a Pazron and you gave generously to a poor person, such that he was able to be charitable, Tzid Kasoy, that act of charity continues on forever, because it is something which enables charity to the mitzvah of charity to pass through many hands, and ultimately it's also the kind of a mitzvah which has a durability and an eternity about it. Finally, one other commentary, which is certainly a very clever, but I should warn you, a little bit complicated. There is a verse that relates to the mitzvah of the menorah, which we read about in this week's portion. In Parshas Baha'aloscha, where this is addressed again, the text describes Aaron HaKohen's fulfillment of this mitzvah, and it says, Vaya'as Kein Aharon. Aaron did so. Cain. He did so. He did, in other words, he did as God instructed him. Or as Moses instructed him in God's name. He fulfilled the mitzvah as Hashem had instructed him. Rashi's observation on that is, Melamed Shvechei Shel Aaron. This comes to teach us the praise. It comes to praise Aaron Shaloshina that he did not in any way depart from or modify or change the mitzvah of lighting the candles. So everybody is very, very troubled by this observation of Rashi. What do you mean? You have to tell me that Aaron was a from Jew, that Hashem told him to do it this way, and he didn't change. Of course, he didn't change. Aaron did what he was told. So, which person would take into his own hands the God fearing person would take into his own hands the right to restructure a mitzvah as he feels like it. So what does that mean? Melamed Shvach Shel Aaron. This comes to inform me about the praise of Aharon Shaloshina, that he in no way changed the... So, commenting on this, my grandfather cites a Dvar Torah of his father on a Medrash, which is an astounding Medrash. In next week's Torah portion, there is Hashem tells Moshe that he should write down this Torah. So here's the Medrash. The Medrash says that the ministering angels of heaven complained to the Almighty in the following way. They said to God, you're giving Moshe permission to write the Torah? You know what's going to happen? At some time in the near or distant future, Moshe is going to say, I wrote the Torah. He will take, if you allow him to be the one who records the Torah, he is going to one day stand up and say that he's the author of the Torah. So Hashem says to these angels, Chas v'shalom, heaven forfend, that Moshe would ever do anything of that sort. And even if he does, Nemanu, he is trustworthy. As it's written, Lochein Avdi Moshe, not so my servant Moshe, Bechol Beisi Nemanu, he is trustworthy in all of my house. That's Hashem's praise of Moshe. Not so, my servant Moshe. In other words, all the other prophets are whatever, but not so Moshe. Moshe, b'chol beis hinenu, he is trustworthy in all of my household. So this is the whole medrash is just not an intelligible. What were they complaining about? So, in unraveling this medrash, the first Bob Verov, my great grandfather, takes yet another medrash, which is a very puzzling medrash. Here's what it says: God said to the wicked, "I created the world, in which creation I uttered the words Vayihi Chen, and it was so." Throughout creation, God said, "Let there be a firmament," and it was so. And God said, "Let there be vegetation," and it was so. He said, "I created the world in which I uttered the words, and Vayihi Chen, and it was so. And you wicked people, you say, Lo Chen, not so." As it's written in the verse, "V'leiv kesilim leichen," in the heart of the foolish, exclaim, "Not so." Chayechem, God says, "I promise you, al kein lo yakum reshem b'mishpat." For this reason, al kein, the wicked will not stand in judgment. So, about this, my great grandfather commented as follows. He said, it's very interesting, there's an anomaly in the text of creation. In every other instance, God said, "Let there be a sky," and there was, and it says, and it was so. God said, "Let there be vegetation," and it was so. God said, "Let there be the lights of the firmament," and it was so. There's one outstanding exception. And God said, "Let there be light." Doesn't say, "and it was so." It says, God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. So the commentaries ask, why don't you just say, "And God said, let there be light," and it was so, just like you do in the rest of creation. Why do you say, "And God said, let there be light," and there was light? So our sages explain that the reason for this is because when God said, "Let there be light," it wasn't so. When God said, "Let there be light," God's intention was that there should be a light that would be of such power and force that people would be able, by dint of this light, they would be able to see all of the secrets of the universe, all of the secrets of the divine hand in creation. Everything would be revealed. There would be no obstacles. Neither time nor space. People would see from the beginning of time to the end of time. People would see from one end of the world to the next. But God also saw that the wicked would abuse this divine light. And so rather than allow this light to be abused, God concealed it. So when God said, "Let there be light," it wasn't so. Because He concealed the light that he had intended and replaced it with, "and there was light." That light that is referred to, "and there was light," is not the same light that God spoke when he said, "Let there be light." So the reason that there's this exception is because God said, "Let there be light," God intended for one kind of light. "And there was light," that was a different kind of a light. That was a light which was the kind of light that we're accustomed to. It's a physical light. And there are walls in that light, and there are obstructions in that light. Now the question is, what happened to it? Where did God conceal it? When he concealed the original light, where did he conceal it? Where he concealed it for the righteous in the time to come. So the intent, God's intent, will ultimately be fulfilled. In the meanwhile, the only way we can access that light is through Torah and mitzvahs. Those people who study the Torah with the proper purity and innocence of heart, with a proper fear and love of the Almighty, those people who perform mitzvahs with a proper kavana, those people can access some of this light. So with this observation, it turns out that we can now begin to unravel some of these very perplexing midrash. The Almighty said, I created a world in which it's written, and it was so. That was what I intended, that's what I really wanted should come about. Even about that original light was what I intended. But you wicked, instead of allowing me to write, Vayihi chen, and it was so, the wicked say, Lo chen, not so. In other words, they make it impossible for me to write the word chen. So I had to write instead something else. I had to write and there was light. Therefore, I take an oath, God says, that because you have precluded me from writing this word Cain even into the first day of creation, Al Cain lo yakum reshoim b'mishpat. That's the explanation of this concluding verse. Therefore, Al Cain, because of the word Cain, lo yakum reshoim b'mishpat. That's why the wicked will not stand in judgment. Having established that explanation, he then proceeds to explain that what the first Medrash was talking about was that God told Moshe write the Torah. So Moshe started to write the Torah. And when it came to writing the second or third pasuk, Moshe wrote, Vayomer Elokim Yehi Or. Vayehi Or. God said, let there be light, and there was light. So the angels knew that what he should have written was, and God said, let there be light, and it was so. So they assumed that Moshe had intentionally distorted the text. So they ran to God, and they said, hey, he's doing this on his own now. He's writing what he wants to write. So the Almighty responded to the angels by saying to the angels, Chas v'shalom, Moshe would not distort by an iota anything that I had told him. And even if you see that he seems to have distorted the thing by writing Vayihi Or rather than Vayihi Chein, you should know that lo chein avdi Moshe, the fact that Moshe did not write Cain was not on his own, because b'chol beisi nemenu, Moshe is trustworthy in my own and throughout my home, and you should understand that he knows why we couldn't write the word vayihi chein. With that understanding of the Medrash, my grandfather proceeds to explain this anomaly with Aaron. He says, when Aaron went over to light the menorah, that he performed that mitzvah of lighting the menorah in such a way that he accessed the original light. The light which would have allowed God to have written in the text, Vayihi Chein. So when the pasuk says Vayas Cain Aharon, and Aaron did so, right? So Rashi quotes the comment of our sages, which said, "Melamed Shvach Shalom." You want to hear a praise about Aaron? You know how great Aaron was? Shaloshino. The way Aaron did the mitzvah, it would not have required that the text should have been changed to Vayior. The way Aaron did the mitzvah, the text could have read Vayihi Chein. So by Yas Kin Aaron, Aaron did the mitzvah in such a way that would have allowed for the text to be written. And Vayhi Chen. That's a commentary of my grandfather, where he uses a very wonderful insight of his father in explaining the midrash. So we have reached the conclusion of the chapter in Bava, and whether or not we proceed any further is still up in the air.